From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And so the FBI's Russia investigation is back in the headlines. The Washington Post reporting special counsel Robert Mueller wants to question President Trump in the coming weeks about firing National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and FBI Director James Comey. The Post also reports that shortly after Trump fired Comey in May, the president asked Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI, who McCabe voted for president. And Republicans who head four congressional committees are alleging corruption and bias at the FBI.
Meanwhile, there is no deal on immigration in sight on Capitol Hill as another government shutdown looms in just under 3 weeks. Here now, political analysts join us this week. Corinne Jean-Pierre, a Democratic strategist. Hi, Corinne.
Hello.
And Matt Mikowiak, a Republican strategist. Hi, Matt.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And I want to start with immigration and the shutdown. California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein said the shutdown battle that Democratic leader Chuck Schumer waged over an immigration deal may not have been the wisest course of action. And immigration hardliner Republican Tom Cotton said he didn't think Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made any concessions to Democrats. So, Corinne, let me start with you. Who won and who lost in this shutdown?
Well, I'll say this. I think the people that won were the 9 million young people who are poor kids who need health insurance, and they will be being held hostage by the Republicans in the Senate, in particular Mitch McConnell, who refused to put that to the floor to make sure that a bipartisan agreement, which is CHIP, which has been around for some time, didn't get to the floor to get voted on something that would have been reauthorized. And I think that is a win for those 9 million sick kids.
Because that was in the plan.
It was in the CR that was voted on Monday. But saying that, I'm glad that happened. But I am incredibly disappointed in Democrats for not holding the line, not staying strong, and not fighting for DACA recipients who are thinking every day. And some dreamers are being deported, about 100 or so of them every day. And it is incredibly disappointing. But now we move on to round two. And as you guys just mentioned, February 8th is the next deadline.
Well, Matt, what about Republicans here? Because, yeah, everybody's saying that maybe Democrats realized quickly that although people overwhelmingly are for extending DACA, this deportation protection for millions, they very much don't want the shutdown either. And so Democrats were seen to be, you know, scuttling about to try to, you know, change direction. But Republicans were once again seen as not supporting DACA, and that's going to happen over again. Didn't Republicans lose as well?
Well, I think all incumbents lost to some extent, because I think most people don't pay attention to the small but important details in these battles. They just see dysfunction in Washington and they blame everyone. Now, in this case, it's pretty clear that Democrats prevented the government from staying open on Friday when the deadline hit. And the only concession Schumer got is it went from a 4-week extension to a 3-week extension, which is an immaterial irrelevancy. But sure, to the fundamental question of DACA, I do believe there is a bipartisan majority in both houses to solve the DACA issue. But you have to do something about the underlying problem, which is a system that allows people to come here illegally. Because if you put these individuals into a greater state of certainty, it may welcome other people to bring their children in the short term if we don't address border security.
I just want to jump in there because we need to be clear. DACA is a program that's over. You had to have come within a certain time frame, within certain years. Mm-hmm. You had to come. And so it's not as if you are now renewing DACA itself. It's that those who came in those years would have the extension that they expected. It's not about extending DACA to people who are just now arriving.
Right. But I mean, don't you think that that the same sort of emotional connection that people have to these children that exists now would exist in the future if another wave of these individuals came in? I guess the question is, do you want to fundamentally solve the issue of a porous border? That's really the question. And I think Republicans are saying, yes, we can give a pathway forward to legalization for those children that are here, but we need to solve the fundamental problem of border security at the same time.
And let's get to that point. Here's Chuck Schumer speaking yesterday.
We're going to have to start on a new basis, and the wall offer is off the table.
He says the wall offer is off the table. Corinne, is the wall so bad that Democrats should hold up action on the Dreamers over it?
I think the wall is a racist idea. I mean, look, if you look at the studies say that there are actually less people. Hardly anybody is crossing the border anymore. The wall is not even needed because of those numbers, if you look at those numbers. But, you know, I think the most important point about that is even with Chuck Schumer offering the wall, which is clearly was a staple in Donald Trump's campaign, he still said no to the deal, that bipartisan deal that Chuck Schumer offered him last week that Donald Trump blew up, the second bipartisan deal that Donald Trump blew up, which makes you think, well, does Donald Trump even really truly want a bill of love as he asked for, and does he really want to fix this problem? And I think what that entails, what that means, is that this really goes back to the Hill and the leadership on the Senate and the House side to really try to fix this problem. Because as we have seen, Donald Trump has not helped this this situation at all. And when it comes to, just want to be really clear here, when it comes to DACA recipients, and I agree with Robin, it's like these are folks, 700, close to 800,000 young people who we made a promise to, who are really giving. They're not criminals. They came. You can't be a criminal being DACA recipient. 900 of them or so are in the military. These are young people who are part of the fabric of this country and don't know anything else but this country. And so we need to keep our promise that the United States has made to them.
Well, in fact, Matt, let's talk about how this is being discussed through ads and tweets and messages. There's tweets from Trump and robocalls to voters in several states saying that Democrats are prioritizing undocumented immigrants. Now, of course, DACA is, as we just, it's a separate issue. There was that ad released last weekend, and this is not from a PAC. This is from President Trump's reelection campaign. Let's listen to part of it.
Democrats who stand in our way will be complicit in every murder committed by illegal immigrants. President Trump will fix our border and keep our families safe.
Democrats will be complicit in every murder committed by illegal immigrants. Your thoughts on that ad, the messaging that's happening, and also how does President Trump, you're the strategist, how does President Trump get away with holding something up for a demand for money for a wall that he promised that Mexico is going to pay for?
That's a good second question. So let me kind of try to address this in different ways. First of all, the notion that Schumer put the wall on the table is not accurate. He put an authorization on the table, not an appropriation. I mean, the Secure Fence Act that passed in 2006 was fully authorized. It was just never fully funded by Congress, and a current Congress cannot bind a future Congress in spending. So it's a little bit of a phony offer from Schumer in the first place, but it was interesting to watch over the weekend that even Luis Gutierrez, the very pro-immigrant Democratic member of Congress from Illinois, was willing to admit that the wall could be built if they could get a deal on DACA. So it's interesting that that messaging has changed on the other side. But look, I do think the contours of the deal are coming into clearer view. Obviously, you want to try to address this population of 700,000 or 800,000 people that came here as children. We separate adults from children in our legal system in the sense that adults are responsible for their actions and children are not. And so I think that Republicans, broadly speaking, want to see that get dealt with. But as I said before, they want to address the fundamental issue. Do I think there's been language used on both sides on the extremes that have been unhelpful? Yes. I also know that in the CR, the Senate has said they're going to move to immigration on February 8th if there's another shutdown. And so they're going to either consider immigration on the floor of the Senate February 9th, or they're going to keep the government open and keep negotiating. And there is a bipartisan group now that is discussing this in the Senate. The question of whether you can find a final deal that can get 60 votes in the Senate and get a majority in the U.S. House remains an open question.
Okay. I am jumping ahead like eight topics now because we only have 2 minutes left, and I want to get to something that we keep having to push off and never have time for it. But I think if it were President Obama that we were talking about, we would be talking about this every single day, which is Stormy Daniels. The Common Cause watchdog group says the Justice Department should investigate a $130,000 payment that President Trump's lawyer made to a shell company that allegedly paid this porn star Stormy Daniels in the weeks before the election last year to keep quiet about an alleged affair with Trump. Corrine, is this story going anywhere? Should Democrats be talking about Stormy Daniels?
Look, I worked for President Obama the first 2 years of his administration. I totally agree. If this was President Obama, it would be he would, you know, be getting impeached or whatever. There'd be committees asking for his impeachment, however you would like to say it. It would be just, you know, all hell would have broken loose. So clearly we don't see that with Donald Trump, which is not all that surprising. But the way that I see this is that, look, this was two consensual adults. I don't really care about it. That's between he and
Melania. They're both denying it, by the way, now. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
They're both denying it, both of those, okay. those adults. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. Whatever. What I do care about, I have to say, is that, you know, we know that there has been a case, people who have come, women who have come and out and said very strongly and accused Donald Trump of being a sexual harasser, sexual assaulter. We've heard stories of him walking in locker rooms of teenage pageant contestants. And I think that's the story that I really want to talk about, I really want
to
hear about.
We're going to have to wrap it there with Karine Jean-Pierre, the Democratic strategist, and Mac Mikowiak, the Republican strategist. We'll have you back to ask, why isn't Mexico paying for the wall? Thank you both.
This week, Kentucky became the latest state to sue a national opioid distributor. Kentucky Attorney General Andy Beshear says the McKesson Corporation flooded his state with massive amounts of opioids using unfair, misleading, and deceptive business practices. McKesson is one of a number of drug companies summoned to the federal courthouse in Cleveland next week for what's being described as preliminary settlement discussions with hundreds of state and local governments and private groups from across the country that are suing drug companies over the opioid crisis. For member station WCPN IdeaStream, Nick Castell reports.
When the opioid crisis started to take hold in Ohio, few places had it worse than Scioto County. The county's fatal overdose rate for the years 2006 to 2010 was twice the state average and the highest in Ohio. According to the Ohio Board of Pharmacy, almost 9.7 million doses of opioids were dispensed in the county in 2010, the equivalent of about 122 doses per capita.
We have a needle exchange program here. We basically, every Friday, we see 225 regulars that are IV drug users.
Lisa Roberts is with the health department in Portsmouth, the county seat. Early on, she says, the people at the needle exchange were abusing painkillers by injecting them. Today, that's changed.
The same people switch to heroin.
There are fewer prescription painkillers dispensed in Scioto County these days after the state cracked down on so-called pain management clinics. But drug overdose deaths are still above the average in Ohio. The number of people in the county who died in 2016 was almost 60% higher than in 2010.
The prescription painkillers just created this mass of people who are opioid dependent, and the drug dealers recognize that.
Scioto County and Portsmouth have joined more than 100 other jurisdictions across the country in suing opioid makers and distributors. One set of lawsuits alleges that distributors filled suspicious orders of pills despite having a duty to maintain controls against the diversion of drugs for illegitimate uses. Another group of suits accuses drug companies of misrepresenting the risks of opiate addiction despite knowing better. Many of these cases have been consolidated and are now before U.S. District Court Judge Dan Polster in Cleveland. Brian Fitzpatrick is a professor at Vanderbilt Law School.
I suspect the defendants are going to feel a lot of pressure to settle this case.
The cases have been compared to the multi-billion-dollar tobacco settlement of 20 years ago. But Fitzpatrick says there are differences, too. For one, drug marketing is regulated by the FDA in a way that tobacco wasn't.
The question is going to be, did their marketing line up precisely with what the FDA had approved, or were they marketing these products off of the uses that the FDA had approved them for? And then there's going to be questions of, did they lie to the FDA? Did they know that these things were more addictive than they let on?
Lawsuits in federal court allege that the drug makers marketed opioids through third-party groups outside the purview of the FDA. Maria Glover, a professor at Georgetown Law School, says the local governments would have to demonstrate that companies' alleged deceptive marketing changed how people use opioids.
They would have to show that that caused doctors to change their behavior about prescribing, that it changed consumer attitudes toward requesting these drugs.
In a statement, one of the companies, Purdue Pharma, denies the allegations against it. It's not the only one.
Every day, opiate abuse affects families and communities across America.
This is from a video recorded by John Hammergren, the CEO of the distributor McKesson, one of the defendants. The company denies shipping opioids to what it terms rogue pharmacies. The video was produced in response to a Washington Post 60 Minutes story claiming that the Drug Enforcement Agency did not adequately monitor McKesson's opioid sales.
Some of the media suggests that we're to blame for the opioid crisis. This is simply not true.
Judge Polster has said everyone shares some responsibility for the crisis, and no one has done enough about it, from drug companies to governments. Polster said he wants to see a settlement between the drug companies and local governments that reduces the number of pills and ensures they're being used properly. If that doesn't happen, the judge says he'll try the cases brought by governments in northern Ohio. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
Well, now to the Women's March, which was a little overshadowed by the government shutdown last weekend. After last year's historic marches, there were criticisms that the marchers were too white, too white-collared. Writer Lavanya Ramanathan said women of color, quote, saw privilege in the women posing for photos with grinning police officers at a time that people of color were afraid that to even drive through a stop sign might lead to a police confrontation. At this year's march, there was a push for diversity, and there were more women of color and blue-collar jobs, including domestic workers, nannies, house cleaners, home care attendants, who stepped out of the shadow economy and onto the streets. And looking forward, a number of Democratic congresswomen are planning to wear black to President Trump's State of the Union address next week in solidarity with the Me Too movement protesting sexual harassment and assault. And activists will be gathered for an alternative to the State of the Union to voice what they see missing from this administration. Well, Ai-Jen Poo will be one of the speakers there. You may remember Meryl Streep brought her to the Golden Globes. She's executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, something like the AARP for domestic workers. She's also part of Time's Up. That's the movement from Hollywood to bring attention to sexual harassment across industries. And Ai-Jen now joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Ai-Jen, we spoke to you years ago as you started this effort to organize domestic workers. You have come a long way.
The movement has come a long way. When we first started, it was so hard to just get 8 women in a room together in a church basement to share stories. And today we've passed domestic worker bills of rights in 8 states. Yeah. And it's taken thousands and thousands of women who've stepped forward and courageously advocated for this workforce. So I'm definitely proud of all we've accomplished.
Well, you and others estimate that there are maybe 2 million women, that sounds like a low number, who work, you know, in the shadow economy.
Yes, it's definitely more than 2 million. It's just so difficult to get the numbers. But what we do know from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is that one segment of this workforce, the workforce that cares for our parents and our grandparents and our loved ones with disabilities in the home, is the single fastest growing occupation in our entire economy, anticipated to grow at 5 times the rate of any other workforce.
Yeah. Well, you tried to get 8 women in a room, and in 2003, there were about 200 women who gathered and talked about the need for protections and took their ideas to the Immigrant Rights Clinic. This is at New York University School of Law. What are some of the changes that have been made and others that you're still looking for?
Well, a big national change that we've been able to achieve is under the Obama administration, we worked very closely with the Department of Labor to eliminate the exclusion of over 2 million home care workers from minimum wage and overtime protections. State by state, we've been able to do different improvements in the way that the state-based labor laws protect domestic workers. Wherever possible, domestic workers have protection from discrimination and harassment, a day of rest, paid time off, maternity leave. Each state is a little different, but I think we're trying to make progress wherever we can.
How's that regulated? Because I'm sure there are people saying, gee, I wonder if one of those is my state because I have somebody come in and clean the house, let's say they might be saying, or I've got a nanny taking care of my kids. I didn't know I was supposed to pay them minimum wage or give them time, a certain amount of time off. I mean, how is it regulated and monitored?
Well, this is one of the challenges is there's so many people out there who are really concerned about the rights and the dignity of this workforce and want to do the right thing, and it's not always clear what that is. And that's why we've partnered with a group called Hand in Hand, which creates all kinds of resources for people who employ domestic workers and caregivers in their home to understand what it means to pay a living wage, offer paid time off, have a clear work agreement.
Well, and you also point out that Time's Up, which is the movement that came out of Me Too, specifically created a fund to support low-income and underrepresented women. Meanwhile, you're working to increase wages for domestic workers in Georgia to get a domestic bill of rights in Seattle. But you also say that, you know, the average person can do something here if they're feeling kind of disconnected from this issue. Literally go up to someone that they see maybe working in their own home.
You know, this is definitely a movement for everyone. And I think for those people who are concerned about valuing domestic workers and caregivers, which we all should be because we will all need care at some point in our lives, go up to somebody and connect them to organizations like mine. Women can actually get connected to their peers, be a part of a community. They can get access to training and benefits and all kinds of resources.
Well, but what do you do about the fact that many of the women that you're speaking of, they're not just working in the shadow economy, they're living in the shadows. They may be undocumented.
Yeah, and in those instances, I think it's particularly important that we express to our undocumented sisters that we stand with them, we support them, and we're there for them. And the organization that I mentioned earlier called Hand in Hand has a campaign called Sanctuary Homes. And it's all about how you can, as a neighbor, as a friend, as an employer, really support the undocumented people in your community.
That's Ajin Poo, Executive Director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She's also involved in the Me Too and Time's Up movements. And by the way, just briefly, what will you be saying in the alternative to the State of the Union?
We're going to talk about what is the state of things in this country from the perspective of very diverse women all over the country, really sharing their perspectives of what is the state of our union and what are the solutions that can get us to the country we know we all deserve.
Ajin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
Save the Children has temporarily suspended all of its activities in Afghanistan following that attack today on the aid agency's offices in Jalalabad. ISIS is claiming responsibility for the attack that left at least 3 people dead, 24 wounded. In the latest terrorist strike in the country over the weekend, more than 20 people, including some Americans, died when Taliban gunmen stormed a luxury hotel in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The BBC's Alia Atrafi is in Kabul. Alia, what more do we know about today's attack on the Save the Children office, about 50 staffers in the building at the time?
That's right. It was about 9 in the morning when, in the classic fashion of the latest attacks, a car bomb explodes at the gate of the Save the Children, and then other fighters go in. It created a chaos where about 6 other cars were seen on fire, and then a lot of children going to school were running away bare feet. And then the fighters went in. But the staff, the about nearly 50 staff that were there had managed to get to the safe room.
Well, many of the recent attacks have been on Afghan security forces. But these 2 latest attacks, you know, at the hotel, on civilians, Save the Children, aid workers. Now, did either ISIS today or has the Taliban spoken to why they would attack civilians and a group that saves children?
This is most curious, the Save the Children in particular, because ICE, while accepting responsibility, did not give any reasoning or justification for the attack, which normally they do. What can be understood from this attack is that the insurgents groups are trying to destabilize the government to discredit it in the eyes of the international community and to frustrate the international community. This is at a time where the insurgent groups in Afghanistan are under a lot of pressure. After President Trump came into office, the pressure on the insurgent groups has increased dramatically in Helmand and in other areas. So this is a way of them transferring that pressure back to the government.
Meanwhile, there are still thousands of American troops in Afghanistan. How does that factor into this string of attacks, if at all?
I think the fresh involvement of the Americans is greatly benefiting the security forces in Afghanistan. Really taking the fight back to the Taliban, we see Afghan special forces attacking Taliban heroin factories, their commanders. So lately it is making a huge difference.
And is perhaps that why the Taliban and now ISIS are fighting back? I mean, are these last gasps or reactions to that?
I think adapting to the situation. And now, once again, they realize that they can't fight the Afghan regime and the Americans as an army. So they're switching back to the insurgent attacks and suicide bombers that create headlines and that are softer targets than fighting an army that has airplanes in the sky and drones. So they're really adapting and they're changing their tactics.
That's the BBC's Alia Atrafi in Kabul, Afghanistan. Alia, thank you.
Thank you.
A new book out this week looks at how the hippies of the 1960s and 70s shaped the food we eat. It's called Hippie Food, How Back-to-the-Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. It is written by San Francisco Chronicle food writer Jonathan Kaufman, who joins us now. Jonathan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me on.
And when you say hippie food, how do you define that exactly?
For me, hippie food was basically the foods that I grew up eating in the 1970s. Brown rice, tofu, granola, yogurt, sprouts, nut loaves, and other sort of brown, hearty, whole grain food.
And you grew up eating it because you were the child of hippies or what?
My parents weren't hippies at all, actually. I grew up in a small Mennonite community in northern Indiana. But these ideas about food had spread from the counterculture into, you know, the heart of the country by the mid-1970s. And so liberal Mennonites were eating this diet as a way to live more lightly on the land and eat more healthfully.
Well, yeah, tell us about the origins of this movement. Where did it come from?
It was a sort of a funny patchwork cuisine that took ideas and ingredients from the health food movements from Southern California of the 1930s to the 1950s, from macrobiotics, which was a philosophy and diet introduced to America by George Osawa, that it was basically a Japanese peasant diet with a sort of spiritual bent. And then the counterculture's own ideas about politics and how eating could be a political act. And then they flavored it all together with these from the flavors of non-Western countries, bringing in a lot of ingredients and foods that really weren't part of the American diet at that time.
Well, one of the foods was brown rice, which grew in popularity. Tell us about that. Why was that so important?
Brown rice was important for two reasons. One was that it was a whole grain, and I think counterculture kids were really interested in avoiding industrialized food, and the way to do that, they felt, was to get food that was as pure and whole as possible, so they could avoid any processing. The other reason was that macrobiotics, this diet that focused on balancing yin and yang in the body, was based on the idea that, you know, brown rice was the principal grain. And so, in fact, you know, in the early macrobiotic diet, they believed that if you ate nothing but brown rice and miso soup for 10 days, you could completely change the cells in your body.
Hmm. Which you would want to do why?
To bring yourself in balance with the universe, which would bring you health and also much more happiness.
How much did all this have to do with people in the 60s and I guess the 70s who had done a lot of drugs wanting to sort of detoxify? Really? I mean, it's a serious question.
I think there definitely was that influence, especially with early macrobiotics. People would, you know, get off LSD or stop smoking pot and do the brown rice diet in order to sort of purify themselves. What I heard more from people was that a lot of folks converted to vegetarianism after doing acid and feeling the sense of oneness with the universe and feeling like they didn't want to eat animals after that.
Hmm. You also talk in here about brown bread. Now, back in the 60s, white bread was what you found in the supermarket, but then a lot of people started going with brown bread.
Yeah, less than 10% of bread sold in stores in America was whole wheat bread at that time. But again, it was this movement to try and take control over the diets and wrest control from the corporations that were making food. And a lot of young kids really were becoming aware that there were not only vitamins were being lost in the milling process, but they were introducing chemicals and stabilizers and, you know, all of these things that they didn't know what they were into this sort of fluffy, white, tasteless bread.
It was also kind of a reaction to all of the pesticides and additives and processing that was going on in the food in that time.
Yeah, the 60s and 70s were a period when we as a country were taking stock of the repercussions of using pesticides like DDT. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring came out in 1964, and it had a huge impact on both the psyches and on, you know, sort of the politics around using pesticides. But also there were other exposés about, you know, the potential dangers of chemical sweeteners and additives. And so I think counterculture kids decided they might as well just get rid of it all, and that would be the safest option.
I want to ask you about a restaurant that you talk about in this book called The Source, and a man named Jim Baker, who would become known as Father Yod, who was the leader of what kind of sounds like a cult of people that wanted to go along with his way of eating.
And I think members of the Source family are comfortable with that word cult. Hmm. He had been a bodybuilder, aspiring actor who moved out to L.A. in the 1950s. And he and his wife opened this early natural foods restaurant that was nothing like hippie food. But he had a kind of conversion experience partially after he kind of committed a couple murders in self-defense and went down. He had kind of a breakdown and rediscovered himself and food through through spirituality. So he eventually became Father Yod and was teaching a colorful spirituality, but it also was combined with a largely raw foods diet. And so he and his followers all lived together in a big mansion. They all dressed in white, long flowing beards. He had 13 wives, and they had this incredibly successful vegetarian restaurant in L.A. that drew everybody from producers to rock stars to the general public.
And the food was at the center of this whole idea?
It really was. I mean, because I think they felt like the food that they were eating would uplift them spiritually as well as physically.
So what happened to this movement? Because it's certainly not as pronounced today as it was back in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s.
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of it was fashion changed. A lot of the young counterculture kids who had, you know, devoted themselves to eating all whole grains and avoiding sugar, they grew up a little, they had kids, their kids didn't want to necessarily have the same diet, which is, I can attest, was definitely a factor in our household. And I think that the food in America evolved a bit more, too, and it became more complicated and frankly, better.
The whole hippie food movement, in a way, has gone kind of mainstream. We're all eating, you know, whole wheat bread and things like
Definitely.
That.
Definitely. Yeah, what was really remarkable is to look at 1970 and what nutritionists were saying about things like whole wheat bread and brown rice, and they were sort of poo-pooing the nutritional value of all those foods, to now when the USDA nutritional guidelines recommend that we eat, you know, half of our grains should be whole grains. And I think it's because that generation, their ideas about health there was a lot of soundness to it, and science ended up backing them up.
You know, there are a lot of people in this country who don't want anything to do with this kind of food. They just find it not that attractive. What do you think about that? That even though we know that there are lots of benefits from eating food like this, that a lot of people just don't like it.
Right. you know, I don't think that I think the counterculture really wanted to change the way everyone eats. And we've seen that didn't happen. But they introduced all of these foods that are an option for people. And so I don't think you have to eat no sugar or completely avoid white bread. But they did give this other path that people can choose and incorporate it in their diet in subtle ways, even as subtle as, like, you know, having oatmeal once a week.
How much of a connection do you see between the hippie food movement and farm to table, which we see in a lot of restaurants now?
There's a very direct link in the sense of the back to the landers who moved from cities, you know, to small towns and ended up becoming the backbone of the organic movement. They helped set up farmers markets in a lot of areas in order to directly sell their food to customers. They made connections with restaurants, and eventually, as the organic produce became more beautiful and varied, restaurants definitely bought in.
Jonathan Kaufman, why did you want to write this book? What did you want to tell?
I wanted to talk a little bit about my own origin story. I hadn't really paid much attention to this food until maybe 10 years ago when I was a restaurant critic and I went to a vegetarian restaurant in Seattle and realized, oh, this is the food that I grew up with. It's disappearing. There are probably all of these amazing stories behind, you know, why we were eating these foods, and the time to interview everybody, you know, who was involved in the movement is now.
How much of it do you still eat?
I actually eat more whole grains now than my parents. And because of writing this book, I do make brown rice and whole wheat bread a lot more often than I used to.
That's Jonathan Kaufman, whose new book is called Hippie Food: How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Larry Nassar, the sports doctor who admitted to molesting some of the country's top female gymnasts, was sentenced today to 40 to 175 years in prison after a week of often furious testimony from 150 women. Judge Rosemarie Aquilina said it was her honor to sentence him.
Sir, I'm giving you 175 years, which is 2,100 months. I just signed your death warrant.
Lindsay Smith of Michigan Radio is part of their team covering this story taking place in Lansing in a courtroom there. Lindsay, this was televised. What was that moment like when the sentence was given out? 175 years tops.
There was a lot of mixed emotions in that courtroom. I think most people were definitely happy with this sentence. There was some survivors of the abuse who had asked during their testimony if the judge would consider giving him life in prison. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is that it was part of a plea deal, so he would then be able to withdraw that plea if she did not follow the sort of sentencing mm-hmm. guidelines along with this plea deal.
Yeah.
So I think most people were pretty happy about the sentence.
Yeah, there's some technicalities. Well, the judge, before the sentence, gave Nassar quite a dressing down. Let's listen to a little bit more.
Your decision to assault was precise, calculated, manipulative, devious, despicable. I don't have to add words because your survivors have said all of that. I don't want to repeat it.
Now, Lindsay, and the survivors, the testimony has just been incredible to hear.
Yeah.
Women crying, angry, cursing at Nassar during the past week. Today, the judge read a letter that apparently he'd written to the court last week.
Yes.
Kind of, I guess, his defense or something that he was laying out before the court, saying that his accusers were seeking media attention. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. What was it like when that letter was read in the courtroom?
There were audible gasps in the courtroom. I think so we don't have the full text of the letter because the judge decided not to release it. But she read pieces from that letter, including that hell hath no fury line, mm-hmm. Which is definitely, like I said, there was gasps. That the media is sensationalizing this, and that he also said, I was a good doctor because my treatments worked. And now those patients are speaking out. The same ones that praised me came back over and over again. It was the media that convinced them it was wrong and bad.
Well, of course, as many of the women said, some were as young as 6 years old when these manipulations took place under the guise of treating them. Others said that they'd been told never to question anyone as gymnasts. He must know what he's doing. And Of course, it was assault. Look, he also apologized. He maybe had a change of heart after a week of hearing this testimony. How did that go over?
Yeah, he apologized, and during his apology, he turned around on a couple of occasions and spoke directly to the survivors, which was the bulk of the folks that were allowed in the courtroom today. You know, it's very difficult to say, you know, to make generalizations about how people feel. A lot of victims still felt like they knew him as a nice guy, or had these conflicting feelings. So it's been a tough run for them, for sure.
That one young woman who said, "I need you to say you were sorry," and he did, while she in her testimony. And then she said, "Thank you." She needed to have that connection. Look, the chair and several board members of USA Gymnastics stepped down this week. Yep. Survivors want others held accountable, including leadership at Michigan State University. That's Nassar's former employer. What could happen there?
Well, there's a lot going on at MSU. The NCAA sent a letter to Michigan State yesterday afternoon to the athletic director and said, "You know, look, this seems like a big deal. We would like more information. So far, we haven't received any information from you," because it wasn't just gymnasts at MSU; it was rowers, there was softball players, regular grad students who would end up seeing Larry Nassar, and then he would do these so-called treatments. He would find his way to be able to do that. So I think there's definitely still some fallout potentially on the table. There's been other calls for independent investigations at Michigan State University at the criminal level to see if there was any kind of cover-up. So I think we're definitely still going to keep an eye on that for sure here.
And we should remind people, Dr. Nassar was sentenced in another case. This is a child pornography case. He'd been sentenced to 60 years in prison for that. And then he has another sentencing later this month. Will that still happen given this sentence?
It will still happen. It will likely not be have this, you know, 7 days of victim testimony.
Yeah.
And then there's the civil lawsuits, of course, in federal court that are still pending.
Right. Lindsay Smith, reporter with Michigan Radio. Again, it's Dr. Larry Nassar, former USA Gymnastics doctor, sentenced today 40 to 175 years in prison. Lindsay, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
And as she said, it is not over. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.